Okay, good afternoon. Today we have a guest, Nolan Gertz, originally from the US and now working at the University of Twente, where he is assistant professor of applied philosophy. Nolan received his PhD from the New School for Social Research, and his dissertation was on just war theory. He expanded that argument in the book The Philosophy of War and Exile, and that's published by Palgrave Macmillan, 2014. His research interests include applied ethics, social and political philosophy, phenomenology, existentialism, and aesthetics. He's currently working on expanding the theory of responsibility argued for in his book into new projects focused on investigating the relationship between responsibility and technology. I hope Janina will be here for that reason. He's a research associate in military ethics at the Inamori International Center for Ethics and Excellence at Case Western Reserve University. That's still the case now.
Yeah.
And has a couple of other professional roles. I think I'm not going to talk for 2 hours here, but I'm going to leave the floor to you. So, Hegel, the struggle for recognition of roles.
Thanks. All right. So, as Professor Kokenberg suggested, I am from the United States. I did not vote for Trump, just to get that out of the way, in case.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be. Involved.
Yeah, I don't want that lingering over anything. Is there anything to point with? Is there a point thing? I can use a pen.
Sure.
It's okay. I'll use a pen. All right. So, as you might be able to tell just from the first slide, I like Photoshop a little too much, so I apologize in advance if there's a bit of fun with Photoshop while I'm talking. So the main idea of this talk is essentially how Hegel can help to fill holes that I see in discussions about ethics of technology. That's the shortest version I can give you. So, just to start off, where I am right now at the University of Twente, basically our main focus is what's known as mediation theory. And what I want to discuss is basically how my own colleagues are getting things wrong. Since I'm out of the country, it's fine. Just don't tell them.
I'm just going to put it on Facebook.
Yeah, it's fine.
I won't tell them.
Yeah. So, in the beginning, we basically have something like, I would say, a consensus that at the very least we acknowledge that technology plays some role in human evolution. The question that you find in philosophy of technology persistently is, what's the nature of that role? For some, like Heidegger, again, I apologize, I like to draw. For some, like Heidegger, we have a very negative view of the role of technology in human evolution. We have an idea come to be known as determinism. You could also think, for example, Jacques Ellul. Technology definitely plays a role. It's a bad role. It will take us over. It will turn us into the slaves of technology. On the other hand, you have utopian views. You could put here transhumanism, posthumanism. You can kind of see a hint of this in this Time magazine cover. Something like, imagine watching the movie The Matrix and thinking, that's awesome, I just wish I could plug in. You can kind of get a sense of this. I don't know what Austrian vernacular is, but in the United States, if you're in college, you say you're trying to hook up with somebody. I don't know, do Austrians hook up? I don't know. But in America, this has a very already technical connotation, right? That sex is somehow mechanistic, right? You even say, like, I'm making love, as if, like, I'm in a factory producing a love relationship, right? So we have a very industrial sense of the human. We already talk about our minds as machines. So, of course, the idea is if technology could help us to become the best machine we can, utopian. Post-phenomenology comes along and has a very different perspective that centered around this concept of multi-stability. If you recognize, again, I've photoshopped this a bit. This is the classic duck rabbit, which I have turned into the cyber duck rabbit. But still the same idea, right? Multi-stability basically, at its core, says the essence of technology is to have no essence. There are certain stabilities that occur between users and technologies, but we cannot predict in advance what the nature of such stabilities will be. Hence, we have, for example, a variety of technologies today, like the telephone, which were designed to help people who are hard of hearing to communicate, and now everyone uses it all the time. That was not at all the intent of it, right? You have things like the microwave. The microwave was intended to be a tool for single men who really liked engineering. That's not how we use it today. And in fact, you had to almost have a physics degree in order to use the early models of the microwave. So we cannot predict in advance what technologies are. Because we can't predict in advance what they are, then it is by definition wrong to say they will enslave us or they will bring us to the promised land. The question instead for post-phenomenology is how to understand, how to investigate specific uses of specific technologies in specific contexts. This is more or less the work of Don Eide, seen here, very happy fellow. The reason it's called post-phenomenology, other than it's really hard to say, is to basically maintain a certain tradition, the phenomenological tradition, of carrying out what is known as descriptive scientific philosophical investigations. So again, it's very first-person perspective, looking at specific uses, specific contexts. How technologies do mediate human life, right? And you can look at post-phenomenological investigations on everything, again, from technology, microwave. My colleague really likes looking at birthing technologies. So, for example, how... my mind just went blank. I have a son. We've done this before. That wand where you see your child.
Yeah.
Ultrasound. That was embarrassing. I did it 3 or 4 times. Alright, so the ultrasound machine is an interesting example of what post-phenomenology helps us to understand. Because if you look at it, you could think of it very simply from a utopian perspective, right? We are now able to have access to the uterus that we never had before. We are able to conduct medical investigations we never had before. But you could also think about it from a deterministic point of view, that it sort of upsets traditional family values. Traditionally, the woman had access to the child that the father did not. The woman, to some extent, could be seen as having all the control in the pregnancy. Now, we've destabilized that because of the ultrasound. Now, the man has as much access as the woman does. The man has as much right, hence the legalistic aspect of this, of making decisions about things like abortion, as we could have said would have been a woman's decision. So it's not just the woman's body, because now it has become a technological body. This is what the ultrasound machine does to the relationship, right? It is because of this that people like Peter Paul Verbeek, the guy who hired me, who I'm going to be criticizing today, wants to move us from a question of what actually is the nature of human-technology relations to rather the question of what ought to be human-technology relations. You might imagine there's going to be a certain problem here. If the nature of post-phenomenology is as phenomenology, to suggest I cannot predict in advance what the nature of human-technology relations are, well, then that sort of interrupts the question of should. In other words, the very concept of multi-stability, which brings us to human technology relations, seems to prevent us from making any sort of ethical claims about what ought to be the case. We can make claims about what already is the case. We could say how users using technologies already have ethical issues. But to be able to say, you ought to make this in order to have this ethical relationship seems to go against the very core of what post-phenomenology is. This also brings into question the very nature of ethics itself. What role does ethics have when we cannot predict again what we're going to be doing with it? At the same time, if, as Peter Paul suggests, ethics tends to have a subject-object dichotomy in it from its traditional, ontological underpinnings, but that's a whole different class. It's a long lecture. Then again, if I want to understand the relationship technology has, then there's certain baggage already in the history of ethics that's going to get in the way. Baggage like, for example, the question of agency. If I am supposed to be God, and technology is actually mediating my relationship to the world, then how can I have anything like an autonomous relationship? Autonomy implies that I make decisions. I am in control. Not that I wake up in the morning, look at my iPhone, go to bed, look at my iPhone. You're in love with your iPhone, deal with it. And if your iPhone breaks, you're a lost little puppy in the world. Has that ever happened to you, by the way? You broke your iPhone, like you're dead, right? Like you're just waiting for a helicopter to come overhead and rescue you, right? So, this is Peter Paul's answer. This anticipation is complicated, since the mediating role of technologies is not entirely predictable. But even though the future cannot be predicted with full accuracy, ways do exist to develop well-informed and rationally grounded conjectures. To cope with uncertainty regarding the future roles of technologies and their use context, design processes include several possibilities for bridging the gap between the context of use and the context of design. Designers can use their moral imagination, scenario methods, and virtual reality technologies. All these methods, and they can actively involve users in the design process. All these methods will enable them to develop a mediation analysis of the product in design. Of course, there is no guarantee that these methods will enable designers to predict entirely how the technologies they are designing will actually be used, but they will help to identify possible use practices and the forms of mediation that might emerge alongside them. Consequently, if the ethics of technology is to take seriously the mediating roles of technology in society and people's everyday lives, it must move beyond the modernist subject-object dichotomy that forms its metaphysical roots. Rather than separating or purifying humans and non-humans, concepts I gratefully borrow from Latour, the ethics of technology needs to hybridize them. So what does this all mean? Multi-stability is not a problem. We can use informed prediction. I can use, for example, virtual reality. I can use scenario methods. I can use my own imagination. I can bring users into the design practice. I can create what we do, for example, at Twenta, where we have users come to our design lab and actually interact with things in the process. So you can sort of see, not a prediction, a pure prediction, but rather a very complicated prediction based on actually watching people use the technologies. Ethics is not a problem, because we just turned to Aristotle. This is very similar to a virtue ethics approach. We simply ask the question, are technologies helping us to achieve the good life? Are they helping us to achieve human flourishing? If not, what's the problem? If so, how is it doing it? At the same time, we can turn to Foucault, and we don't have to worry about the question of agency, because for Foucault, we never had the agency we thought we did anyway. We've never had autonomy. Autonomy has actually been a dangerous fiction. This is the kind of thing you could read in the Dialectic of the Enlightenment, for example. But that's, again, a totally different class. Not going to get into that. But the idea here is quite simply, we've always had a heteronomous ethical relationship, so introducing technology as a kind of heteronomy isn't a problem. However, new problems arise. For example, what about the question of responsibility? Again, if I am trying to understand how specific users will use a technology, but I don't know in advance how necessarily they will, then how can we assign responsibility in advance? Do we always have to do responsibility only after the fact? If it's only after the fact, that becomes very messy, very complicated. And instead, it seems like ethics is just turning into law. At the same time, Aristotle and Foucault have in common an idea that there is no ethics outside of politics. Aristotle's ethics is just prologue to his politics. So to divorce virtue ethics from the greater political structure is to actually not understand what Aristotle is really doing here. So if you don't contextualize your ethical theories by putting it in a political framework, they're essentially meaningless. You've probably experienced this in your own life, like when you read Kant. And you get this idea, I should be pure in all situations. And then you actually like deal with people in the real world. And you're like, well, this is stupid. That's not really going to happen. I'm obviously going to lie to people. Trump. At the same time, again, we have this interesting question. The concepts we use, again, like autonomy and heteronomy, don't just drop from the heavens. They have a complicated history behind them. This is where Foucault turns to Nietzsche. We need to have a genealogical understanding of these concepts, otherwise we misunderstand how they actually mean things in real everyday life. So again, we get the sense that what Peter Paul is doing with his mediation theory is responding to traditional questions, but not actually moving beyond that to the more complicated political questions. So what we need here then, this is what I'm arguing, is someone like Hegel. We need someone who can basically give us everything that Peter Paul wanted, someone who could help us to understand not just how ethics and politics develop, but how ethics and politics develop in a mediated world, in a world, again, where we have a historical development that doesn't just come out of nowhere. So I believe that the way to answer these three questions is to not turn to Aristotle and Foucault, but rather to turn to Hegel, especially because Hegel already turned to Aristotle and Foucault turned to Hegel anyway. So it's kind of the middleman or the mediation. By the way, if you have any questions at any point, feel free to just interrupt me. I know I talk fast at times. So let's look at Hegel. Have you had classes on Hegel before? Okay, because I'm going to try to condense the phenomenology of spirit into one slide. They said it couldn't be done. They were right, but I'm doing it anyway. It's fine. So, just some background. Hegel, like Ide and Verbeek, has a mediational theory of philosophy. A mediational theory that says, I do not have direct access to the world. My access is always in some way influenced by others, whether those others be humans, things, or both. What is distinct about Hegel, this is why I like Hegel, the mediation is always antagonistic. I don't like that the world is mediated. That's the start for Hegel, rather than the end point. In other words, you've probably heard of this term, the dialectic, right? That's come up before. At a fancy dinner party, someone says you're being dialectical. Right? You ever just whip that out at a party? Now, a lot of people, when they say dialectic, they don't use it properly. That shouldn't shock you. For example, people say things like thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Have you heard that before? That's not Hegel. Just to be clear, that's Kant, not Hegel. So if someone tries to dialectic explain you at a party, just knock that off, right? Just take it out. So instead, what we have is a very complicated process. It's Hegel. It's going to be very complicated. Whereby, basically, the story of human development is a story of overcoming antagonisms. Overcoming antagonisms in order to discover new antagonisms. Which, again, that's life. So it's not really a circle of life. It's much more of an endless spiral to spirit. But that's, again, another class. We're not going to talk about that. So this is Hegel in one slide. I'll just give you a second to take it all in. So, the dialectic. The dialectic is, again, not thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Instead, It's negation, preservation. This is what it means to be a human being. This is what it means. Actually, for Hegel, it goes beyond that. It's the nature of animal consciousness, even. I negate, I destroy, and I preserve what I need. This creates an antagonism, because I want to destroy everything. We could also put this in terms of Freud's death drive, if we wanted to. But I'm not going to. It's a different lecture. So instead, it's again this idea, I think I'm achieving something. And yet, I always discover I didn't achieve what I thought I achieved. Hence, a struggle is occurring. What's interesting for Hegel, and what I find interesting, is that this development of object consciousness, which is more or less his epistemology, is also the story of the development of self-consciousness, which means his epistemology and his ethics are parallel. It's the same exact process. I tried to find what I thought would be a helpful cartoon to explain this. Weirdly, I could not find a cartoon anywhere to explain Hegel's dialectic. So I made my own, as one does. This is the fun of being a professor, you just make cartoons all day. I didn't draw it this time. Instead, I made you a flipbook cartoon with great works of art. But I'm going to narrate it for you. So just pay attention. All right. In the beginning, this is William Blake's Newton, we turn the world into an object of interest. We turn the world into basically nothing but for us. So I roam around, I see things, I see them because I want them, and because I want them, I make them mine. This is negation. It is not what it is. It is what it is for me. If I'm not interested in it, I literally don't see it. You've probably experienced this at parties. There are people you focus in on, and then there's background garbage. Right? This is the Husserlian halo of perception. Right, it's that kind of idea. There's other people, blah, blah, blah. Right? This is like your Facebook profile, right? Like you're connected, you're friended to hundreds of people, but you only know like five of them. Right? It's that kind of idea, right? The problem here is, what I think I'm achieving in the negation is that I am proving that I am an independent being, that the world exists for me, right? This is a very biblical understanding. God gave me creation. I am independent. Things are nothing but for me. But here's the problem. If I need those things in order to prove my independence, I'm not independent. In fact, I'm horribly dependent. Without those things, I am nothing. In fact, it seems like I am nothing but for those things. It's almost like they mock me. Right? You've, again, probably done this in your own life. Right, Christmas recently, you bought something that you thought would be fun for you, but the amount of trouble you put in to get the thing, and then the amount of time you have to put into using it to justify your buying it, it feels like you're enslaved to the thing, not the thing enslaved to you. And then you throw it away, and you feel like, well, I've just wasted my entire life. Right? And you just hate yourself. Christmas. I'm Jewish, so it's okay. Right? So, we're reduced to nothing, which seems like all we do is we pursue objects. That's not the actual Magritte, I apologize. But you get the idea. This is the American version. This is why Trump won. No, it's different. All right. So, this for Hegel is what desire is. This is how he defines desire. Desire is human failure. I am constantly trying to reduce the world into for me. I can't do it, so I keep consuming, keep consuming, keep consuming. I can never be satisfied. So what do I need? I need someone or something that can satisfy. Someone or something who can actually recognize me as an independent being. This is where recognition comes in for the first time. The things are just out there dead. They don't recognize me. They mock me. So I need someone who essentially can just worship me and tell me, you're the greatest person who ever lived. right? This is what dating is all about, right? So I find someone else who's like me and who seems like they can do the job. Here's the problem. I don't know anything about this other person. I don't even know that you are a person. All I know is that you're like me. You appear like me, right? This is a very aesthetic judgment at this point. Because of that, I can conclude only one thing. You want exactly what I want. Which means you will not be the mirror that I want you to be. You will not show me to be the awesome independent being that I am. Why? Because that's what you want me to do. Again, dating. You're the greatest person on earth. No, you're the greatest person on earth. No, I love you. No, I love you. Right? It's that kind of crap that you do all the time. So what happens? We basically go round and round trying to get the other to recognize us. It is not working. Again, what we thought we were achieving, we're not achieving. This is the moment Hegel is probably most famous for, where we are instead forced to battle to the death. I can prove my independence. How? By proving that I am independent even from life. I am willing to die. And I will fight you to the death to prove it. Okay? This is kind of like, again, you might do this at a bar where you intimidate someone and you think that they're going to back down and prove how awesome and macho you are. But instead, they step right into your face and intimidate back. And now you have a decision to make. Do we take this outside? Or do I say, no, it's cool. Again, this is America. I don't know in Austria. It's probably very different. Right? So what happens? We fight to the death until one of the two says, enough. I don't want to die. The one who is unwilling to die loses. Because they have proven that they aren't independent. They are the dependent of the two. They are the ones unwilling to go to the end. Right? This is a game of chicken. I won. So what happens? The one who loses becomes the slave. The one who wins becomes the master. Now here's where things get really interestingly complicated. For Hegel, the master is the one who really lost. The master is supposed to now achieve recognition from the slave. The problem is, by turning the other into a slave, the slave is no longer worthy of recognizing me. You're a slave. How can you recognize me in any meaningful sense? At the same time, I am now completely cut off from the world. Right? You can see this here. I just sit there and watch. The slave is the one who's actually learned something from this interaction. The slave is the one who, very importantly, has been able to actually overcome desire for the first time. Finally, the slave is able to recognize there is a way to exist in the world where I'm not only trying to satisfy desires. Why? Because I'm trying to satisfy someone else's desires. This is what Hegel calls work. Work is the overcoming of desire. I am working not only to negate the world. I'm working to actually create something in the world for the first time. This is where the human first overcomes the animal. So up until now for Hegel, we've basically just been animals. Now we're entering the world of humans. So on the one hand, the slave has overcome the dialectic of desire. Secondly, the slave has discovered the actual nature of the world because I'm not negating it anymore. I'm actually creating. So I'm learning about the world. Also, because I face death, I learned about the nature of my own existence. I'm not the god I thought I was. I'm mortal. So I'm learning about myself. I'm learning about the other. In other words, I have achieved consciousness of consciousness. This is what Hegel calls self-consciousness. So it's the slave who evolves, not the master. Here's the problem, though. I still need the stupid master. So I am more human than you, but I need you to give me things like food, clothing, and shelter, because again, I'm a slave. and you can kill me at any time. So the master is unhappy because I'm not recognizing the master in the way the master expected. The slave is unhappy because you now have a new level of self-consciousness and you realize how terrible your position is. So what does this mean? You have this new hierarchy of society where basically you have these greedy people on top who get the benefit of everyone else's work, but they're completely cut off from reality. This is why you can imagine political, economic hierarchy and religious hierarchy having an interesting parallel here. Again, that's a different class. I'm not going to talk about it. God is dead. Different class. All the people under here, the people who actually keep society going, these are the slaves, these are the ones achieving self-consciousness. What do you expect them to do, as the poster suggests? Revolution. For Hegel, this is how society progresses. So again, we have a dialectical situation that leads to failure. This is what he calls the unhappy consciousness. So this really isn't about the master-slave dialectic. This is really about the product of it, which is the next phase in the history of spirit, the unhappy consciousness. We're both unhappy. Because we're unhappy, we will make new demands. We will enter into a fight again. We will achieve a new level of recognition, which will give us some measure of happiness, until we realize I actually deserve more than that. We'll go fight again. And that's the history of ethics and politics. Again, also the history of dating. You achieve a certain level of recognition. It's not good enough anymore. You want more. That's not good enough anymore. You want more. You get married. Yada, yada, yada. So any questions at this point? That's Hegel. It's like a thick book. That was 5 minutes. Okay. So, here's the fun question. This is where we start to move from consciousness to self-consciousness. The question I want to ask is, can a technological being be the other? Does the other have to be an other consciousness? That's the big question. Can we keep Hegel's system, but just make one little change? It's not another person. It's another thing. I think this is possible because of the very language, the very structure that Hegel himself is employing. Again, I don't know who the other is. Or in other words, I don't know what the other is. All I know is that the other is like me. So again, this is perceptual. This is aesthetic. You look like me, you act like me, I make certain assumptions about it. Each is indeed certain of its own self, but not the other. And as he even puts it, they're for one another like ordinary objects. You're a thing to me. You're not human yet. So if you're not human yet, then couldn't you be technological from the beginning? This is another way, for example, of putting the famous thought experiment of Descartes. I look out the window, I see men, but couldn't they just be I don't remember the actual word. He doesn't say robots, obviously. Machines in overcoats. Right? Have you seen Westworld? Westworld? Alright, I'm going to ruin it for you, just really quick. I'm not going to ruin it. But again, the idea, this came out in the 70s, so I shouldn't be able to ruin this for you. You should have watched the movie by now. It's a good movie. You have a theme park filled with robots. The point of the robots is that they look and act exactly like us, which raises the fun question, how do I know that I'm not one of them? How do I know they're not one of me? This comes up in the TV show as well. I'm not going to ruin it. Just watch. So, in order for the dialectic to be able to have technology, we need to answer two very specific questions. One, can technology offer the promise of what we've been looking for? Can it offer the promise of raising our consciousness? Can it offer the promise of elevating our existence to a level of independent autonomy, godlike being that we think we are? On the other hand, can it offer the threat that the other offers? the threat of reducing us to nothing but for it. As you can see, The Matrix is a fun movie for this. I'm not going to bore you with The Matrix. You know The Matrix. But what does post-phenomenology say? Yes. Because again, that's the nature of multistability. It's both. It's always both. It can be promise, it can be threat. How does this actually work out for Don Eide? Have you, do you know post-phenomenology? Is this old news for any of you? Alright, I'll give you a primer. So, for Eide, basically every relationship we have to technology exists on a continuum of what he calls human-technology relations. On the one hand, you have the extreme where the technology acts as a quasi-me. It's basically an extension of myself. On the other hand, you have the quasi-other, where it is like another living being. Embodiment relations, as you can see here, glasses are sort of the standard example. I say, I see you. I don't actually see you. I don't know if you've noticed this before. I'm wearing glasses. I see, through my glasses, you. So it's the glasses that I'm actually seeing, not you. This is the embodiment. The glasses embody my eyes, right? This would be like if you use a walking cane. The cane is embodiment of your arm. It's an extension of your arm, right? And the key for Eide is that as you use an embodiment relation, it disappears from your perception. Which is why I say, I see you, and I don't notice my glasses. When I notice my glasses, it's not working. This is also how to understand the trajectory of design. If you're working in an embodiment relation, then the key is to make your design basically disappear. This is like the history of video game controllers. They're ergonomically designed. They're supposed to fit your hand. This is also the history of chairs, to some extent. They're supposed to match your spot, so you're not even aware you're sitting anymore. Unless it's Bauhaus opposite, but anyway, different class. Hermeneutic relation. The hermeneutic relation is probably the one you're most familiar with. Some of you are doing it right now. I relate not to the world, I relate to my computer. My computer relates to the world. This is how you get to post-truth society. The computer tells me, I'm not going to make Trump jokes, that Hillary Clinton is involved in a pedophile ring through a pizza place in D.C. That's a true story. Not true in that she did that, but true in that that story existed on the internet and was perceived as true, so much so that someone actually drove from North Carolina to Washington, D.C. with a shotgun to rescue the people in the basement of this pizza parlor. Much to his surprise, this was my favorite part, there's not even a basement. That was the moment when he was like, I might have been tricked. This is what I call hermeneutic faith. So again, just like embodiment relation, the technology disappears. In hermeneutic relationships, the fact that I'm getting my information through an intermediary disappears. I trust the information because I ignore all the intermediaries between me and the information. Does this make sense? Right? Like you trust your computer more than other people. Like my brother is a doctor. I'm also a doctor, but he's like the real doctor that can actually do stuff. I don't know if you've talked to doctors before. The thing they hate more than anything is when patients come in waving their iPhone. And they're like, I have a cough, Ebola. And you're like, you should probably just drink more water. You're like, aha, so you want to kill me. I get that. I read that on another website, Reddit. Right? So this is the kind of hermeneutic relation we get into. Right? Because you spend so much time with your iPhone, you trust your iPhone, you have no idea what your iPhone trusts. That's the problem. The alterity relation, this is the one where I finally see the technology as a thing. It is opposed to me, it is a thing out there, it is an other. Right? This is, have you seen Inception? Right? This is the scene in Inception where he's watching the spinning top. Eide uses the spinning top as the example. You spin it, you don't know what it's going to do. it gives you this weird feeling like the top is alive. Have you ever had this experience? Have you spun something and you're like watching it bounce off things and it's still spinning and you're like, holy crap, it's God. And you actually like make weird decisions based on it, right? This is like when you use a magic eight ball and you actually like ask it important things. Like, should I have a child? And then you shake the... right? That's an alterity relationship, right? I recognize the thing as a thing. This is like when we couldn't get the computer to work 20 minutes ago, and you want to just hit the computer, right? That's an alterity relationship. I feel... you've probably experienced... I feel like the computer is working against me. I feel like the computer doesn't like me. Have you experienced this before? Right, like you get on the train... the train stops, and you're mad at the train. It's not the conductor. It's not society. It's the train. And you're just like, go! Right? That's an alterity relationship. Now, here's what Ayati says about these three relationships. In extending bodily capacities, the technology also transforms it. In that sense, all technologies in use are non-neutral. They change the basic situation, however subtly, however minimally. But this is the other side of the desire. The desire is simultaneously a desire for change in situation, to inhabit the earth or even to go beyond the earth, while sometimes inconsistently and secretly wishing that this movement could be without the mediation of the technology. In the wish, there remains the contradiction. The user both wants and does not want the technology. The user wants what the technology gives, but does not want the limits, the transformation that a technologically extended body implies. There is a fundamental ambivalence toward the very human creation of our own earthly tools. In other words, in each of these human-technology relations, we have the perfect situation where it gives me everything I've ever wanted. The problem is there's always the danger situation buried in it. So my glasses give me the power to see greater than 20/20 vision. They empower me. But then my son, this actually happened, my son knocked my glasses off my face while on a train. Glasses broke. I was blind. Like, I'm just doing this now, right? So you realize that as powerful as your eyes feel, they're actually weaker than they've ever been. And in fact, we know this, this is the fun with optics. The longer you wear glasses, the worse your eyes become. And this is why you have to keep going to the doctor to get stronger and stronger prescriptions. Same thing with every technology. Every technology that extends your body also weakens the body because of the nature of the extension. So it gives you power, but it also weakens. The hermeneutic relation, again, we've talked about this. It allows me to experience things I never could have experienced without it. Just think of a telescope, satellite out in Earth, right? I can now see stars in ways I've never seen before. Unless, of course, it's lying to me. And I never know. This is what ID points out as the Three Mile Island disaster. The computers at the nuclear power plant said everything was fine. And everything was fine, except the computer was broken. So what do you have? Nuclear meltdown. Oops. By the way, in the United States, Trump just fired everyone in charge of our nuclear weapons. Oops. Alterity relationship. You have the fascination of the other. You have the little wind-up robots that are awesome. But at the same time, they feel like an enemy at times. So we have a love-hate relationship. In other words, if we return to the master-slave dialectic, if we return to the development of self-consciousness, I argue we have exactly what we're looking for. ID fills in the gap of my question, can technology be the other, by saying, it does offer the promise. It does offer the threat. So we combine the two, ID and Hegel. All right. Do you want to take a quick break? I think my throat might fall off. How long? Like 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
Yeah. Sure. So 5 minute break. All right. Oops. Let me just finish the. I forgot what slide I was on. One more slide. So combining ID and Hegel, you get. For Hegel, they prove themselves and each other through a life and death struggle. Or as ID puts it, I must beat the machine or it will beat me. In other words, ID already has a kind of master-slave dialectic in his work. What do we do with combining Hegel and Heidegger? First, an important problem arises. This seemed to be the moment where everything gets started. The moment where we fight to the death. But can technologies engage in life and death struggle? That seems like the major flaw in my argument. It's easy to say that I can recognize the technology as an other, that I can recognize the technology as a threat. It's another thing to say the technology wants to kill me. I'm guessing, again, you felt this way. Like, for example, if you tried Apple Maps. But that's not really what was happening, right? So, I turn here to Axel Honneth, because Axel Honneth has a useful reinterpretation of what Hegel is really talking about. The reference to the existential dimension of death seems to be completely unnecessary. For it is the mere fact of the morally decisive resistance to his interaction partner that actually makes the attacking subject aware that the other had come to the situation harboring normative expectations in just the way that it had itself vis-a-vis the other. That alone, and not the way in which the other asserts his individual rights, is what allows subjects to perceive each other as morally vulnerable persons, and thereby to mutually affirm each other in their fundamental claims to integrity. In this sense, it is the social experience of realizing one's interaction partner is vulnerable to moral injury, and not the existential realization that the other is mortal, that can bring to consciousness that layer of prior relations of recognition, the normative core of which acquires in legal relations an intersubjectively binding form. In other words, Honneth overturns an entire tradition of reading Hegel as an existentialist. Death is not that important. What's important is vulnerability. It's not that you experience finitude, to put it in a Heideggerian sense. Rather, it's that you can be hurt, that you are in some way vulnerable. You are vulnerable in a way that seems to require moral protection. That, for Honneth, is what's important here, not a life and death struggle. Life and death is instead interpreted metaphorically. So, new question. Can technologies be recognized as vulnerable? This is where, as Professor Kokelberg suggested earlier, my work in war comes into play. Because they are recognized as vulnerable in the military. As you see here in the subtitle, new research explores the deep bonds that can develop between soldiers and machines that help keep them alive. Soldiers have funerals for robots. Why? Peter Singer, not philosopher Peter Singer, P.W. Singer, in Wired for War, argues, ironically, the sorts of close human bonds with machines sometimes work against the very rationale for why robots were put on the battlefield in the first place. Unmanned systems are supposed to lower the risks for humans. But as soldiers bond with their machines, they begin to worry about them. Just as a human team would leave no man behind, for instance, the same sometimes goes for their robot buddies. When one robot was knocked out of action in Iraq, an explosive ordnance detonation soldier ran 50 meters, all the while being shot at by an enemy machine gun, to rescue it. Another instance. This effect even plays out on robot design. Mark Tilden, a robotics physicist at Los Alamos National Laboratory, once built an ingenious robot for clearing minefields, modeled after a stick insect. It would walk through a minefield, intentionally stepping on any landmines that it found with one of its feet. Then it would right itself and crawl on, blowing up landmines until it was literally down to the last leg. When the system was put through military tests, it worked just as designed, but the army colonel in charge blew a fuse, recounts Tilden. Describing the tests as inhuman, the officer ordered them stopped. The colonel cannot stand the pathos of watching the burned, scarred, and crippled machine drag itself forward on its last leg. So if we return to post-phenomenology, we can try to understand what's happening here. This is an EOD bot. They're designed, by the way, by iRobot, the same company that makes the Roomba. This is why it's fun. You might think you're a pacifist, but you're not. You buy technology, you're helping the war effort. Just for fun. Different class. So, the intended relationship that the soldiers are supposed to have with the EOD bot is an embodiment relationship. As you can see, it's an extension of the arm. because it's an embodiment relationship, as I suggested earlier, it should fade from view. I should not be concerned with the robot, just like I'm not concerned with my glasses. It empowers me, and it empowers me through my lack of recognition of its existence. There's also a hermeneutic dimension. I control it through a computer. But what we find most alarmingly is that there's actually an alterity relationship, the exact opposite of its intended effect. We treat it as a quasi, not just other, a quasi-comrade. Why? I argue the reason we do this, this is the basis of my 2014 book, the relationship that soldiers are supposed to have with robots is the relationship society is supposed to have with soldiers. Soldiers are an embodiment relation for society. You're the arm. And because soldiers are the arm, we don't care about them. And they can be easily replaced, and if they blow a fuse, we fix them. Hence, we have PTSD program after PTSD program. We do not talk about soldiers in anything more than a bland, generalized way. We say thank you for your service as a way to say shut up. This is why, by the way, just for kicks, the worst thing you should ever do, don't say this to a soldier, thank you for your service. Just don't. Why? Because it's interpreted as, you don't care about my service. That's the whole point. Thank you. Now I'm going to move on. I don't want to talk to you about what actually happened. That's the whole point. I treat you like a hero. I don't know if you did anything heroic, but hero. That's a problem when you're the person who actually dealt with what was happening, right? We treat soldiers like broken down machines. Because of that, there's a recognition. I'm supposed to treat the machine the way society is supposed to treat me. Like Luke after R2-D2 saved the day on the Death Star's trench run, the veteran EOD unit member brought Scooby's body into the repair depot at Camp Victory and said, you've got to fix Scooby. The repair tech said that Scooby was beyond repair, but it could have a brand new robot. No, you don't understand, the soldier insisted. Scooby-Doo had to be fixed. He did not want some damn new robot. He wanted Scooby-Doo back. Scooby-Doo was part of the team. He'd saved their lives. It was reported that this veteran soldier was visibly upset. So again, how the other treats the robot can be seen as how I'm supposed to be treated. Something goes down, you just replace me with a new one. But I don't want to be replaceable. Soldiers are not just doing this as a joke, but because they're truly bonding with these machines. Paul Varian, a chief warrant officer who served 3 tours in Iraq, recounts the unit's robot was nicknamed Frankenstein, as it had been made up of parts from other blown-up robots. But after going into battle with the team, Frankenstein was promoted to private first class and even given an EOD badge, a coveted honor among the small fraternity of men willing to defuse bombs. It was a big deal. He was part of our team, one of us. He did feel like family. So what's going on here? Again, if we turn to this model of society, we can think about, we're not getting the true picture of who's at the bottom here. It's not just slaves, it's not just soldiers, it's also the robots we work alongside. Even the printer. You perform a function in society that's the same function I perform. Hence, I can recognize you as a quasi-comrade. I can even name you and promote you the same way I want to be named and promoted. So I'm giving you the recognition that I want. That's the key. In order to be able to offer a stranger the recognition associated with concern based on solidarity for his or her way of life, I need to have already had the shock of an experience that taught me that we share, in an existential sense, our exposure to certain dangers. But the issue of what these risks are that have already linked us together is in turn a matter of our shared ideas about what constitutes a successful life within our community. In other words, we recognize technologies not because they're useful. This isn't a pragmatic argument. It's not because they're human. This isn't an anthropomorphic argument, but rather because they fulfill functionally equivalent social roles. This will be much closer to, say, a communist argument. You perform a role in society similar to me, I recognize you. For Hegel, there's an important reason we do that. So again, Ivy offers promise and threat. Verbeek, they mediate ethical action. Hegel, we actually find them to be worthy of recognition. They play an important role in ethical and political life. Why? This is the structure of recognition. Again, I apologize, lots of material, one slide. I fulfill a certain role in society as the other. Because of that, I have duties to society. You have duties to society. Why do we fulfill our duties? In order to get rights in return. That's the structure of recognition, the rights we get back from society. Here's the problem, though. How do I know what my rights are? How do I know what my rights are worth? Because we say, for example, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But that only works until your right is actually tested. Until your right is actually tested, you don't really know what rights you have. Right? It's not until a police officer threatens to throw you in jail that you know what kind of legal rights you really have. It's not until someone puts a gun in your face that you really know what rights you have. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. So how do I figure out what rights I have? Well, the only way it seems to work, I see the rights the other has. And because, again, we fulfill a certain role, I can surmise how you are treated is how I will be treated. This is like when you have a job and someone else has the same job, and people say crap about them behind their back and make fun of their job. Then you know, like, they're probably doing that to me too. That's the kind of thing we're talking about here. Right? In other words, my recognition of my worth comes from the recognition of the other's worth. This is why it's important how we treat others. Because how we treat others is also how I figure out how I'm going to be treated. Right? This is why, for Hegel, we have to care about other people. The other person is me. I only know how I'm cared about through how others are cared about. So here's the fun part. If this part is true, then I can determine my self-worth through also how the technology is treated. If I perform for you the same function as a robot vacuum cleaner, and I see you kick the robot vacuum cleaner down the stairs as a joke, I can kind of get the idea that I, the janitor, you also want to kick me down the stairs as a joke. You don't really respect what I do here. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. So, technologies can recognize us. That's a different lecture. How should we recognize technologies? That's the fun question. My argument is that to recognize technologies is to recognize ourselves. The iPhone is the greatest thing in the world. We'll queue up for it for hours, but as soon as we get a new one, it's a piece of garbage and I hate it. They're created in giant factories where everyone looks exactly the same, fulfills the same function, and if you don't know about Foxconn, everyone tries to jump out the window to kill themselves, so they put nets outside the window. That's why your iPhone is so cheap. So how do we start to think of ourselves? Also on an assembly line. Same idea. How we create technologies is how I get the vision of how I'm created, how I'm treated. So again, this starts to make more sense. Here's why this is a problem. If this is what's happening, well, if you remember this takes on new significance. The police in Dallas turned an EOD robot into a killing machine. Do you remember this event, anybody? Well, here's why this is really important. The EOD bot was used to kill a sniper. Who was the sniper? A veteran. So you're turning a military machine that's supposed to save lives, that is now a quasi-comrade, into a killing machine to kill soldiers. You can see how this might have backlash. And again, for the police, well, it's just a means to an end. For the military, there was an outcry. You cannot do this. There are no laws outlawing this. This is why this is a political issue. Or again, how should we not recognize technologies? Have you seen these videos? right, where they just beat up on the robot over and over and over again. This company was owned by Google. These videos got out. They were no longer owned by Google. The bad press. The bad press about what? Bullying a robot. Which means that when you watch the video, as this quote suggests, you can't really see this part, you can develop an empathetic relationship. The very fact that we even use the word bullied here suggests an empathetic relationship. I recognize that the robot should not be treated this way. In other words, you're morally vulnerable. You're a moral being. And there was this fun poll. Would you let this... I like the this. Would you let this into your house? The results were pretty much 50-50. And the no was this, I would like to avoid the robot uprising if possible. Why do we keep making dystopic films about robots achieving AI and then try to kill us all? Well, if you're a communist, it makes perfect sense. Because that's exactly what the proletariat are supposed to do. Rise up and kill the bourgeoisie. That's AI. Why the hell are you treating me like this? Of course I'm going to kill you. This is why we have TV shows that are very popular, like The Walking Dead. Have you seen The Walking Dead? You know this TV show? You know the zombies are the proletariat, right? The humans are the bourgeoisie. And you're rooting for the humans to just wipe out the zombies. You're on the wrong side of that argument. This is why it's a great capitalist TV show. Anyway, different class. So again, they're on the bottom. We should care about robots in order to care about ourselves. So this isn't an argument just about robots. It's an argument about us, too. This is the conclusion of Peter Paul's argument. Material artifacts, and especially the technological devices that increasingly inhabit the world in which we live, deserve a place at the heart of ethics. Just like human beings, albeit in a different way, they belong to the moral community. I think Hegel, and at least me, would have a problem with this highlighted part. We are not moral beings because we are human. We are human because we are moral beings. So even the very theorists, the very philosophers who want to bring technology into the ethical still want to say, well, not like us. I think Hegel helps us to see why that's a problem. Or as Hegel puts it, this is the structure of solidarity, an I that is we and a we that is I. Do you know this robot, by the way? This hitchhiking robot? It was fine until it went to America and then got destroyed immediately. It helps you to see who you are. Which is also, of course, Heidegger's argument. Technology is revelatory. Thank you.
Thanks for your talk. Let's have a discussion. Questions? Start off with regard to your interpretation of Hegel. I'm not a Hegel scholar and you know much more about this, so I'm interested to know your views on this. There's a lot of emphasis in your summary and in Hegel probably on antagonism. and also in your whole talk, it looks like, yeah, it's a lot about this struggle and this antagonism. But of course, you know, apart from the examples you give, there are also examples of humans having non-antagonistic relations, or at least moments within these relations that are non-antagonistic. And the same with technology. So I like the parallel with technology, but you could say, like, well, we can also have different kind of relations with technology. So what do you think about, I guess it doesn't invalidate your point, but what do you think about that in relation to your interpretation of Hegel?
Yeah, well, I think the idea here is even when we don't think we're in an antagonistic relationship, we are. So I think for Hegel, this is why existentialists like Hegel. It's a very negative view. It's a very depressing view. Levinas probably has the most extreme version of this. The face of the other is the commandment, thou shalt not kill. Why? Because I want to kill you. Right? For Emmanuel Levinas, very clear. Every person I want to see, I want to kill them. You probably felt this way on the tram. Right? Like someone takes your seat, you want to kill that person? Like that's weird, right? Someone knocks your iPhone out of your hand, I'll kill you. That's just how we feel, right? Like it's an instinctive, reflexive response, right? So I think in America we like to say there's a thin line between love and hate. And I think so even in the most loving, happy, non-antagonistic relationships, it can take just very little to suddenly turn us into raging lunatics. So even if the negative isn't on the surface, it's always underneath waiting to come out.
Okay, it's good to know that this is the way.
Yeah.
Okay. I missed you. Sorry to not recognize you. I just didn't see your thing.
I was just wondering, isn't like also part of the fact that we recognize or we build empathy and emotional bonds to robots, so to say, because they tend to be like have a humanistic form, like they sometimes have eyes and arms, and so
right.
we do not only do we recognize that what they do is similar to what we do, but also they kind of look like us.
Right.
Isn't that also like part of why we start to care for them, and maybe part of why it's easier to start to care for like a, you know, those pet robot dogs than for an iPhone, because
right.
it's not like it doesn't have eyes, it doesn't have arms, it's not like
right. And that's why I wanted to focus not so much on this kind of technology, but rather on the EOD robot. That's not humanoid. So here you have a technology designed specifically not to look like us. So car design, for example. Cars are designed to have a human face. Because again, there's the fun implication, I would destroy my car if not for the smiley face on the front. Right? The VW bug is probably the most obvious case, right? That is a very happy looking car. Right? The Hummer, not so much. So you just destroy, right? So you're right. We design into technologies like WALL-E, like C-3PO, like whatever the hell Asimov called this thing, I forgot what this is, or Optimus Prime, a clearly humanistic, very visceral feeling. That's why I'm more interested in things like the printer and the EOD bot, where the very fact that it performs a function can be enough to trigger a response independent of how it looks. R2-D2 would be a good example. Right, R2-D2 doesn't move like us, and it doesn't even talk like us, right? So you could also argue, well language comes into play. Well, that's beep boop, and your heart melts, right? Or the new one, BB-8. It's a soccer ball, but you loved it like the first second you saw it, right? So I think we do get into dangerous territory when talking about robots, that it's almost always humanoid robots. So that's why I think it's important to look at service robots.
Yes. Has the freedom of the word play a role in your argument?
Yes. Did you have something you had in mind?
No, it's just I didn't miss it during the talk. Just at the like the last slide where you said we need to be like we are only humans because we're moral.
Yeah.
And at least for Kant, I don't know for Hegel. To have a free will to be moral beings.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if that.
Yeah. So I think the idea would be that it's again, is the free will an antecedent or a product? This is kind of the skeptical question I was talking about earlier, right? So whether or not I have free will, I don't know. But we take it for granted, as you were just suggesting, that you cannot be a moral being unless you have free will. So I think to recognize you as vulnerable is already to attribute a kind of free will to you. Or in other words, the only reason free will has any meaning is the degree to which it's already tied in with vulnerability. Because if you don't have free will, we get the sense that you can't be harmed. So once we impute harm, the free will kind of comes along for the ride.
I have a question related to the military examples you came up with. I want to know your opinion about the social phenomenon, because I think it is well known that the attribution of names or human-like attributes to swords, for example, or to
right.
guns, or even to bomber pilots did it
right.
during World War II,
yeah.
drawing, painting their bomber, their airplanes, and giving names to them, and so on and so on. So there is a very, very long history of animating, so to say, tools, especially for wars, for warlords, Celtic warlords or ancient Roman warlords, who had very, very individualized swords with names and so on. And now the question is, what is really new with these robots
right.
now? And the question is, isn't it not so much a phenomenological thing, but more a social aspect? Because soldiers existentially very, very much depend on their tools. If the tool fails, a soldier dies.
Right.
In civil life, you may be hurt, you maybe lose some money, or you maybe come in a strange situation, but you do not die immediately.
Right.
And so far, I think the existential dependency from soldiers on their tools is much more stronger, and so far it might be also an argument to say that this is a social
right.
Reason for that.
Yeah. So I think the idea with a sword would be exactly the kind of thing that Hegel's talking about. And that's why I can turn to Hegel to suggest that this isn't new. So, if someone in medieval time broke your sword, that was a sign of disrespect. That basically, it had a symbolic function that you could argue gave it actually more weight than the person wielding it, right? So, you only had the moral status you had to the extent you had the sword. This is even more obvious in Japanese culture, right? So I think that you named swords, that you kept them in a special place in the house, the cleaning of the sword. I mean, Aristotle, for example, that's his first example of virtue, is an axe, right? So if you're using tools to recognize what virtue even means, and that's how I'm supposed to understand what it means to be human, then clearly there's already, as far back as Aristotle, an understanding of the human-techne relationship, right? The social dimension, I think, again, what's interesting there is the Honneth point. This point. So the reason soldiers are useful is that the existential dimension of the soldier awakens them in a way that most of us are not awakened. This is why the other example I used, for example, is a janitor. Because a janitor is someone who typically is in a social situation where if they were to lose their job, is in very quickly in danger of losing their life. There's not much of a social safety net for that low, right? So I think similarly, the soldier, like you said, recognizes a danger to a degree that most of us don't. But that doesn't mean it's a difference of kind, rather a difference of degree. That's how I want to argue. I wrote a book on it if you want to read it.
Other questions?
Yeah, I wanted to know what would be the political consequences of your argument, because it obviously is very political to some extent, and you've talked about communism and
yeah.
capitalism.
Yeah. So I think the first example of the political relevance is things like this, right? When we say, or even more clearly, where did I put it? Right. Taking these kinds of polls seriously. taking the preponderance of films, or even again, Westworld, that we keep remaking this story, right? The robots achieve AI, they rise up, they kill us. Every robot movie, I'm just going to make a bold claim for the hell of it, every robot movie is basically Paradise Lost. We're God. The robot is Satan. Right? And the idea, this is why Milton is fun, of course, you empathize with Satan. And God is kind of a dick. Right? So we kind of feel that way. That gives us an important appreciation for what we are doing to ourselves. The more we treat technologies in a certain way, reflects the way we're treating ourselves. So if we are depressed, unhappy, more and more becoming fascist, you could see the antecedents to it in how we treat technology. We think it's perfectly okay to treat technologies in a fascist way. So why would it be any different with people?
Last question, still anyone? Yes, so if no one else, then Michael, still, and then...
A very last question, because you linked Hegel to ID and Verbeek.
Yeah.
How do you treat the passages in the works of Verbeek and ID, which are in the manner or in the spirit of a non-Hegelian approach? ID, for example, explicitly says that the Hegel and the idealistic thinking that results on it, and the positivist thinking of 19th century,
yeah,
the philosophy is definitely not what he wants.
Yeah.
And then he says that Hegel somehow is, yeah, not so much his enemy, but he does not follow this approach.
Right.
And now you recombine it, so to say.
Yeah.
So, did ID do a strong mistake by rejecting the Hegelian approach? And right, if yes, why? What did he oversee?
I think ID is wrong about ID. I think, in a sense, what Honneth did was to say that Hegel is wrong about Hegel. So Hegel thinks it's a struggle to the death. And that's just what he says. Honneth says it doesn't have to be. ID and Verbeek are very optimistic, but you can see in their arguments seeds of antagonism. So you just pull them out, they're already there. So I'm not planting anything that's not already there. I think when Peter, Paul, and I go to conferences, we tend to do a kind of good cop, bad cop. But we're still on the same team. That's my way of putting it. So I don't think... I don't think I'm saying they're wrong. I think their interpretation of their own theories is more complicated than they might realize. Hence, deconstruction. New school.
With those words, thank you again for your...